Back together again, we wrap up a very busy week, Friday, October 7th, 2022, on Connecticut Today. I wondered why, year after year, Connecticut has some of the highest power costs in the entire U.S. It never seems to get any better. University of New Haven Professor Dr. Howard Stouffer talked about the possibility of a nuclear weapon being used by Russia. Immigration attorney Renata Castro returned to the show to talk about the continued migrant problem at the U.S. southern border. I'm fired up about electricity rates today. I don't know why, because fortunately I live in a town that we own our own grid, so our rates are like one-third of what people pay generally for Eversource, the old Northeast Utilities, and a lot cheaper, too, than, you know, people pay that are customers of the UI company. But boy, this is a case, again, another case here of how we always try to, we always try to Band-Aid situations in this state. We never look at the root causes. And this is the thing that drives me crazy. You know, it doesn't mean that, for example, finding ways to make stuff cheaper and more affordable and get us out of this vortex of money and dollars going over the top is easy. Nobody's saying it's easy. The good things, the profitable things, the things that are good for us, they're hard. You know, it's not easy. They're hard. These things are hard, but something we never, ever, 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 or ever, are ever able to do in this state. Think about it, really, as you're sitting and settling in here with me on a Friday afternoon. Think about it. We never really hear any of our leaders, Democrat or Republican, liberal, conservative, whatever, say we've got to make things cheaper for everybody in the state. In other words, we always are in these Band-Aid situations where, when you think about it, we never address the root problem. What am I driving at here? Let me tell you. Earlier in this week, a couple of days ago, I saw this story. And by the way, if you want to chime in on your energy costs, how much you pay, why you pay it, did you make a change maybe in the way you heat or cool your homes? Did it become just too much for you? Now get this. Listen to this with me on a Friday. I saw this story in the Connecticut Examiner a couple of days ago, and I kind of had this filed away, you know, to get to it eventually. Proposed low-income electric rate. A proposed specific low-income electric rate could raise costs for some of Connecticut's poorest customers. So, again, think about that. We're trying to figure out a way. Only in Connecticut, only here. We're trying to figure out a way to lower costs for some of the low-income folks in the state. And yet, the plan they've come up with, we're getting warnings now that it could actually raise costs for some of Connecticut's power customers, right? How strange is this? And think about, you know, if it's people largely, I guess, like you and I, who may not qualify for some of these programs. And again, I've said this before and I'll say it again. In no way, shape, or form am I against programs to help the more needy among us, the less fortunate among us. That's part of the societal safety net that we should afford people who need it. I get it. But again, this does not get to the root cause of the problem. This story from Brendan Crowley, a reporter of the Connecticut Examiner. Now get this. Advocates for low-income electric customers say a proposed discount rate could end up costing some of the state's poorest residents more on their electric bill. Now, think about that. We're pushing, or there are some lawmakers and advocates pushing for this lower rate that they say is going to cost more money. PURA, the Public Utilities Regulatory Agency, is proposing. Now, get this. Now, follow along here, because this is the kind of thing you hear about and you go, what? Huh? PURA is proposing a discounted rate for low-income customers, but that proposal would end the below-budget payment plan, which caps monthly payments at $50 for about 5,700 of the state's poorest electric customers. So once again, Pura, you know, Pura is supposed to be this white knight saving us from the utility companies, which they never do. I mean, come on, seriously. Oh, we're going to get Pura involved. And what do they ever do? Have they ever really, to a great deal, stopped a big rate increase? I don't know. You tell me. Maybe they have. Pura says, well, let's do this discounted rate for low-income customers. But apparently, talk about chasing your tail in this state. Apparently, according to this story in the Connecticut Examiner, that proposal would end the below-budget payment plan, which caps monthly payments at $50 for just under 6,000 of the state's poorest electric customers. Pura, their proposed rate would instead, now follow along with this, because this gets real geeky here. Pura's proposed rate would instead offer a 10% discount on the monthly bills of customers earning less than 60% of the state medium income, which is about $76,000 for a four-person household, and a 45% discount for the poorest customers who are eligible for benefit programs, including Medicaid, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and Supplemental Security Income. Bonnie Rosewig, a lawyer with the Center for Children's Advocacy, said the concept of a low-income discount rate that aims to keep poor customers' bills at an affordable range could address some of the long-running issues stemming from high energy bills in Connecticut. Now, let me stop there. And I don't need to, because who knows whether this will go anywhere anytime soon. But the core issue we finally saw, and this is not criticizing this story in any way by Brendan Crowley in the Connecticut Examiner. The core issue is exactly what I read there in the final sentence of what the fourth paragraph of this story address some of the long-running issues stemming from high energy bills in the state. There you go. So, you know, can somebody please explain to me, because all you hear is gibberish on this, why we never get to the core issue here, is why are electricity rates in this state so damn expensive outside of the cities and towns, I guess 10 or 11 cities and towns that have their own grid or generate their own power. But 155, 159 cities and towns, their customers or the people in those cities and towns are customers of either Eversource or the UI company. Now, I understand that these companies are operating legally. I'm not accusing them of anything. So if you work for Eversource, if you work for UI, that's not the point. The point is that every single year, year in and year out, decade in and decade out, Connecticut, for some reason, and I still haven't heard a good enough reason, why is it? Can somebody explain to me why our electricity rates are so high? No, honestly, can somebody please explain to me why year in and year out our electricity rates are so high? And look, I don't live in Eversource territory. I don't live in UI territory. But the one thing I keep reading, and maybe you people who do get bills from UI and from Eversource can learn me on this. The one thing I keep hearing and reading is that there are all of these ancillary fees on there, and that some of these transmission fees are actually, in some cases, higher or just as high as the fee you're actually paying for the electricity, which has always fascinated me. So help me out here. 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Again, God forbid that we address actually why Connecticut power bills are so high. I mean, depending upon the ranking you look at, second, third, or fourth in the country every year, year in and year out. Why is that? I don't get it. I don't understand it. Now, I have an idea to try and, you know, and it would take years and years and years and years to do. But some other areas have done it. Should Eversource be taken over by the state? It's happened before. Wanted to shift our attention after we started off with some great calls regarding electricity rates and all that. Let's look around the world if we can for a minute. Now, the president, Mr. Biden, kind of raised a few eyebrows when he made some comments at a Democratic fundraiser this week about the world being as close to a nuclear problem or nuclear weapons, the closest we've been, rather, since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, the White House walked that back a little today. They did a little damage control on that. And to talk about that and whatever else is going on in the world, particularly with Russia and Ukraine, we welcome back one of our international affairs experts, a professor at UNH in the national security realm at the Henry C. Lee College of Criminal Justice. Dr. Howard Stouffer joins us, serving in the Foreign Service of the U.S. from 1980 to 2005. Hey, Dr. Stouffer, good to hear you again. It's Paul at WICC. How are you?
Great to be here. Thank you.
What'd you think, Doctor? I know that, you know, Mr. Biden made those comments about Putin, you know, possibly using a nuke, and Putin has said stuff, and now the White House earlier today tried to do a little damage control on that. We haven't talked in a while. What are your thoughts as to what Putin is saying? Is he bluffing? You think he would do this? What are your thoughts?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, Putin has said numerous times since February 24th, when he invaded Ukraine, that he would, you know, use nuclear weapons or consider using nuclear weapons. And more recently, he's made a much more overt statement saying that he's, you know, planning to use nuclear weapons, but in Ukraine, or at least with respect to Ukraine. And that's a criminal thing to do. I mean, for a world leader who has nuclear weapons to even suggest using nuclear weapons is an immoral act. Basically, nuclear weapons, the only purpose they have is to deter other countries that have nuclear weapons from using them against your country. There is no other purpose. They cannot be used in war. They are not effective on the battlefield. Every single simulation that has been run by the Pentagon and by many, many universities around the world always wind up when nuclear weapons are initially introduced at the tactical nuclear level, meaning very low yields. It rises up to the strategic exchange very quickly. So any use of nuclear weapons will not improve the Russian situation on the ground in Ukraine and will only probably lead to worldwide condemnation and possibly, an initial American catastrophic strike. Whether it's conventional or nuclear, it's up to the president. But there would be a response, and it would be a very, very powerful one.
So Putin has to know this, Professor, right? I mean, he's got to know this. So is this just a sick bluff? I know it's hard to get in the guy's head, but what do you think the folks in the Pentagon and the State Department are thinking right now?
Well, I think everybody in the U.S. government now is planning possible contingencies. I mean, he could use a nuclear weapon on the battlefield in Donbass against Ukrainian troops. That would have one kind of response. He could use a nuclear weapon to demonstrate that he really is serious about using them by detonating it in the Black Sea or at very, very high altitude. But any of those scenarios will be first use since, you know, 1945. And despite what he said, that was precedent setting, it was not. We use those weapons because we developed them to be used against Germany because they were developing nuclear weapons. And then when Germany collapsed and surrendered, they were used against Japan so that we didn't lose a million men going onto the island of Honshu in 1945. So the Japanese surrendered. We had no more nuclear weapons after using two of them, and eventually we started developing more. But they were never intended to be used for a strategic exchange. And what makes this situation now different from 1962 is the Soviets put missiles, short, medium-range missiles, into Cuba that undermined our strategic response time. And it directly threatened the United States in a most direct way. The situation now is different. And I don't think it directly affects us, but if he uses a nuclear weapon, NATO and the United States will have to respond. And it has to be an appropriate response, but not a response that would lead to even more conflict and possible, you know, elevating up to strategic nuclear use.
Serious stuff. Dr. Howard Stolfer is joining us for a few more minutes, one of our go-to folks on all things international affairs. He's a professor of international affairs and national security issues at the Henry C. Lee College of Criminal Justice and Forensic Science at the University of New Haven. Dr. Stolfer, these annexation votes, just about everybody in the international community are saying were these scam votes, people pressured to vote in Ukraine. What do you think happens with that? I mean, the fact that these votes were quote-unquote passed hasn't really changed things on the ground. Was this more of just stuff by Mr. Putin for home consumption here?
I think it was not only for home consumption, but for the rest of the world to be put on notice that now that these areas allegedly that are not even defined, because nobody knows what the border of it is, the border coming out from Russia, he was trying to say this is Russian territory now. So if you attack our troops on Russian territory, you're essentially attacking the Russian Federation. And so NATO, you're on notice that if you're providing support to the Ukrainian army now, you're going to be attacking Russia itself. And so he's making this specious claim, this fake claim that this is now part of Russia, and if you attack Russia, then I have the right to attack back, and I can use any means, which is the military way that the Russians fight, that if they once they lose conventionally, they switch to nuclear weapons. And, of course, we know from, as I said, exercises that switching over to nuclear weapons is not an answer because it doesn't gain you anything on the battlefield. In fact, you lose everything on the battlefield and politically around the world from that action.
And also, this comes after this push, Dr. Stolfer, for what, 300,000 more men, fighting men, this sort of conscription or this forced emergency call-up. What do you read into that tactically? I mean, I've read where some experts are saying, hey, this means he could be in trouble. This could mean that the things are really not going the way he thought. What did you read into that?
Well, as everybody has said, this is a desperate move. You know, conscription is deeply resented. 200,000 men have left Russia in the last few days or in the last week or two. And, you know, bringing these men without any training, without enough equipment, without any ammunition, and not fighting as units so that they're not formed units when they're going into the front lines, they're just going to be slaughtered. And, you know, he's leading them to, you know, total annihilation. He's a desperate man. He's made a mistake. He won't back off. He won't admit, as Khrushchev did in 1962. Khrushchev said, okay, I see the light. I know I made a mistake. You gave me an off-ramp, President Kennedy. We got to figure out an off-ramp for Putin to be able to walk away and say, okay, you know, it's over, and we're not going to come back and try to do this again. But I think calling up these 300,000 troops, some of which are allegedly appearing on the front lines now, together with opening up his prisons. He's now taking people in prisons and putting them on the front lines and paying them. So this is an action of a desperate man whose army is disintegrating, literally falling apart.
Is that off-ramp, Dr. Stolfer, if it ever comes, is it going to require land? Is that what he's going to need to back off on this or not?
I don't know. I mean, Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, says he will not compromise on land. And why should he? I mean, imagine if Mexico attacked us and said, we're taking back all the Southwest because you Americans took it from us years ago, you know, two centuries ago. I don't think we would stand around and say, okay, now let's just take New Mexico and Arizona and we'll keep the rest. It's just not possible. And I don't see how you get out of this until Putin either comes to his senses or he's, you know, he's forced to resign or he's killed or something happens over there that, you know, enough people are saying, this is a disaster. The Russian army has been shown to be, you know, incredibly incompetent and not capable of acting like a major power in the world. And this is going to affect their relations with all of their neighbors, the Chinese and the Central Asians and other countries over time, because now, you know, they're their ability to fight is obviously not very significant and is not respected anywhere.
And Dr. Stouffer, final question. You touched on it there. I wanted to ask you about China. You know, the Russians seem to be trying to cozy up to Xi Jinping on all this. And, you know, China kind of won't. They won't put their imprimatur on this. They won't rubber stamp this, will they? It sounds like they're critically thinking about this.
Well, you're right. India and China are seriously backing away. They see this as a losing proposition. And, of course, the United States is trying to round up votes now in the General Assembly. In March, there were 141 countries that voted against Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And now that he has threatened to use nuclear weapons and he has incorporated these areas illegally against international law in Donbass and in the southern regions around Crimea, the U.S. is trying to get at least 141 votes, if they can, in the General Assembly to, you know, condemn the actions of the Russian Federation and Putin once again. So I think he's going to find himself more and more isolated. And when people get more and more isolated, they either do the craziest of things or they get removed. And so let's hope it's the latter and he's removed and that whatever we get in return will be a much more rational player because he's lost the ability to demonstrate that he's a competent, rational player any longer.
And on that, we thank you, Dr. Howard Stouffer from University of New Haven, keeping us up to date with some good opinions here on world affairs, particularly Russia and Ukraine. Dr. Stouffer, thank you. Have a great weekend. We'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. There you go. Well, they laid it out there. Dr. Howard Stouffer, professor of international affairs and national security at the Henry C. Lee College of Criminal Justice at UNH. Long-time foreign service person for the U.S. from 1980, started off in the Reagan years all the way to 2005, retiring as a member of the senior foreign service of the Department of State. So he knows from whence he speaks. A lot of folks into and out of New York City every day from Fairfield County, and you may be well in tune with what's going on in the Big Apple. And again, New York City Mayor Eric Adams earlier today sounding the alarm, saying that, hey, this migrant situation now was really pushing city resources to the brink. Now, you know, still a very hot topic, immigration, migration, documented, undocumented. What Florida Governor Ron DeSantis did a couple of weeks ago, flying some migrants to Martha's Vineyard. Hey, listen, at least on a base level, it has brought this issue to the forefront again, where people need to be talking about it. One of our go-to people on migration, immigration, Florida-based immigration attorney Renata Castro has been on the program, and she joins us right now for a couple of minutes till the bottom of the hour. Hey, Renata, it's Paul here on WICC in Connecticut. How are you?
I am doing great, Paul, especially because I am on my way to the great state of Connecticut as we speak.
You are? Really?
I am. About yes, that. I am.
Are you driving or flying from Florida?
No, I'm driving. I was in Massachusetts conducting a consultation drive.
Okay.
And as you so aptly said, there's a large migrant community in Connecticut and in New York that is being disproportionately impacted by the questionable decisions of certain governors flying migrants to both New York and to Delaware as a result of the quite incensed political scenario as we get ready for the presidential election.
I think, Renata, you have to admit, though, as even people who I don't generally agree with politically, they have to admit it is, listen, Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott, a lot of people may not like what they're doing, but they have kind of walked into the room and flipped a table on this. So at least people are starting, Renata, to talk more about this, because this was one of these things like, you know, shh, don't talk about it. Don't ruffle the feathers. We need to be having a vibrant, maybe a little emotional discussion about this.
I agree. I think that Ron DeSantis and Governor Abbott are taking a page from the Kardashians when it comes to political marketing. They're going for full impact. This is a time in history where only the bold will secure headlines. And make no mistake, they are not really concerned with resolving the issue of unlawful immigration, or in this case, the asylum influx. They are really concerned over how they can use this hot topic to put themselves in the national stage. Ron DeSantis was, you know, Trump's pet, and now is going against his you know, his mentor and is looking for a place in the national arena when it comes to politics. The same for Governor Abbott, a really heated governor election in Texas. And now migrants are in the middle. But most importantly, American businesses that are hiring those migrants, because a lot of them, or the majority of them, from my understanding, are in the country legally because they're here seeking asylum.
Asylum, yes.
They have been inspected and admitted, and the government is spending hundreds of thousands of dollars flying them from one state to the next, going through jurisdictional barriers that are beyond their powers. And for what? Just for headlines? We need to have a meaningful conversation about immigration reform that goes does away with outdated asylum laws that are inhumane and ineffective, but that also cost American taxpayers uncountable amount of dollars in immigration detention and in immigration courts. No one talks about the cost to the American taxpayer objectively, because guess what? That will not guard a vote.
Is Renata, is the first step, and you and I have talked about this before, is the first step, because, you know, listen, this is going to be very detailed to solve this, and my sense is a lot of people want to solve it, but it's a great way for either side, right, to raise money. Is the first step here figuring out something better for the asylum process and the asylum courts? Because I read where those cases can drag on for just years and years and years.
Yes, an asylum case can take up to 12 years in an immigration court. And you once again so eloquently put it, we need to find a better way to execute and process asylum petitions that does not involve individuals crossing the border. A couple of days ago, there were two Russians that reached a remote Alaskan island to seek asylum. And we're going to see, as we see more of economic and political mayhem in other areas of the globe, it's not only going to be the Mexican border. The United States has been the most stable economy during the pandemic, and the United States government needs to find a better way to process individuals who deserve, who fit within the realms of the law when it comes to asylum protections, and bring them to the United States permanently, or allow them to enter the United States permanently with an employment authorization so that they can hit the ground running and work. We need the workforce now more than ever. Today, Governor DeSantis sent out an email pleading that companies doing the Hurricane Ian cleanup hire locals. Only a lot of the locals don't want to do that kind of work. So what do? Do you stop recovery as a result? We as a country cannot afford to do that.
Renata Castro, thank you. Her website, CastroLegalGroup.com, CastroLegalGroup.com. Renata, thank you. And listen, make sure when you're in Connecticut, you have some, and I love Florida. I have relatives down there and friends. Make sure you have some real pizza when you're in Connecticut, okay? Will you do that for me?
I certainly will, and I'll take a photo. But thanks for
All right. Thanks, Renata. Appreciate that. All right.